Welcome to today's edition of Centered, a reasonable conversation about life and faith with your host, Dr. Don Belenis, Ph.D.
In our society, freedom of religion is utterly basic to our way of life. But what would be the net effect of real freedom of religion in trouble spots around the globe? Our guest is Thomas Farr, Visiting Associate Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. He also directs the Religion and U.S. Foreign Policy Program and the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. A former U.S. diplomat, Farr was the State Department's first director of the Office of International Religious Freedom, and he's the author of World of Faith and Freedom, Why International Religious Liberty is Vital to American National Security. Welcome, Tom, to Centered Today.
Glad to be here, Don. Thanks for having me.
Freedom of religion is recognized, or assumed to be, a fundamental right in the United States, Canada, and most Western nations. In other parts of the world, however, full religious freedom can be rare indeed. So how would you define religious freedom in full?
Well, it's a great and important beginning question. I would define it, first of all, as the right to believe or not to believe without coercion from any outside force, whether it be individuals or religious groups, and certainly without coercion from government. So it's an interior right at the beginning. But it also entails the right to act on the basis of religious belief within limits. Most people don't have religious beliefs purely as a matter of therapy or, you know, some sort of philosophical reflection. They grasp or think they grasp religious truths that impose obligations on them and their behavior. And this doesn't just mean when they go to church or synagogue or mosque or temple or whatever it is. They also carry these beliefs out into the world. And if they are citizens of a democracy, for example, their religious beliefs require them, in some cases, to act in certain ways, to try to convince others that their religious claims are true, and to try to shape their own society. For example, most religious communities and traditions have some notion of justice. Well, that's a very important concept in democracy, you know, what justice means, what it requires of us, what our laws ought to look like if they're going to be just. So, in short, religious liberty is the right, the interior right to believe or not, but the right to act within democratic limits, if we can put it that way, on precisely on the basis of one's religious views. So that means, yes, religion in politics, up to a point.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that religious individuals must leave their religious beliefs at the political door. To the contrary, religious freedom means all of these things.
Mm-hmm. One of the more interesting, I think, and helpful and attention-grabbing points that you emphasize in your book and in other writings is that you identify religious freedom as essential for the elimination of religious violence and religion-related terrorism. How so?
I think there are a couple of answers to that question. I mean, religious violence and religion-related terrorism, such as the Islamist terrorism represented by Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, are obviously very, very important issues, not just for the United States, but for the whole world, particularly as we come close to the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, you know.
Yes.
If in fact, my claim and the claim of some others is correct, namely that religious freedom is an antidote to this, it's very important. The idea is that religious freedom engages religious actors in the democratic enterprise. It asks them, it invites them to come in and bring their religious views into the public square. And by so doing, it imposes limits on them, many limits, but especially the importance of the limit of equality under the law. My religious freedom does not diminish yours. So do a thought experiment. Think of Osama bin Laden, who was born and raised in Saudi Arabia. If that country had religious freedom in full, throughout his life, as I've defined it. It doesn't mean he would not have been exposed to these malevolent Wahhabi ideas, which is an interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia. He would have, but he would have been exposed to others. He would have had competing ideas about what Islam means, as you do in some other countries, such as the United States, or such as countries like Indonesia or other democratic Islamic nations. It seems to me entirely possible that this man, Osama bin Laden, and others like him, the 17 of the hijackers in 9/11 that came from Saudi Arabia, would not have had this notion that in order to be true to my religion, I've got to kill people who oppose it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea at the bottom of this. People, God is pleased by the killing of those who offend Islam. Well, that is an idea that is incompatible with religious freedom. So in short, Don, the answer to your question is, equality under the law is a constituent element of religious freedom. It means equality for religious minorities in these countries, such as Christians or disfavored Muslim groups or Hindus or Buddhists or others, but it also gives voice to the moderates.
Yes.
Within the majority communities who can say the bin Laden people, the Wahhabists, the Taliban are not the proper interpretation of mm-hmm. Islam. Had that existed throughout the last half century, the world might be a very different place than it is today.
Yes, indeed. And as you stated a moment ago, your religious freedom does not restrict my religious freedom. And I think one of the things that is implied and which you identify in some of the materials that I've read that you've written, that would necessarily lead to some necessary restrictions on religious agents or agencies.
Sure. For example, some radical interpretations of the religion of Hinduism have in the past suggested that some people, they call them in the past untouchables, were just simply beneath being human. They were subhuman.
Yes.
And should be treated as such in society and politics. Well, that's a religious claim that is utterly incompatible with anything approaching democracy. Or the claim that to be a little less, to go to something a little less violent, the claim that because the United States was formed, which I believe it was, by Christian Judaic ideas, that therefore means that all citizens of the United States must be Christian or accept the notions of the Trinity or accept the virgin birth of Christ. No Christians today would make such arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a restriction on Christian communities in the United States. So to sum that up, the restrictions are characterized by the basic limits of democracy. So that's why religious freedom is not an absolute right, but it is a right that within those limits allow us, all of us, to contend on the basis of our truth claims, to invite others to join our group if they accept those claims. So that's I've just described something that in a very negative word is called proselytism.
Mm-hmm.
But it's peaceful within the construct that I've created here.
Mm-hmm.
You can't trick people. You can't force people. You can't pay people to become Christian or Muslim or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you can. You have the right peacefully to make your claims to them and say, hey, consider this. What
yes.
do you think about this? Is it possible that it's true? If you believe it's true, join my group.
Yes.
If you don't, that's fine. You remain somebody that I respect and your community I respect. So there are limits. Those limits are very important to talk about.
Let's shift our focus to one of the arenas in which you've had a substantial amount of experience, and that's in diplomacy, where words matter, particularly when heads of state speak in that arena. What sorts of important nuances or choices of words, positive or negative, have you noticed, and what have been the net effects in recent times?
Well, the United States has had a policy of advancing religious freedom in a formal sense since the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act was passed. And so that means we've had this policy under now three administrations from both parties. The current administration has had some interesting things happen, but I think President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton are good examples of a troubling trend that has two dimensions in answer to your question. One is to speak some fine words, to make some great speeches that include exhortations to protect the religious freedom of all people. President Obama, some of your listeners may recall, made a speech in Egypt, in Cairo, back in 2009
yes.
to the Muslim world. And then he did it again this year, earlier this year in 2011. I forget where he was, but he was in the United States when he made this speech to the Muslim world. And again, he's a very fine shaper of phrases. He has some great speech writers, and of course, these speeches, presidential speeches, can be quite important if they're followed up by policy action. That generally has not happened. So that's the first part of the answer to your question. But in terms of precise phrases, there have been some troubling usages by the Obama administration, by Secretary Clinton, by the president himself, where they've talked about we need to advance freedom of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, lots of Christians use that phrase. President Roosevelt, in his famous Four Freedoms speech back in 1941 at the beginning of the Second World War, used the phrase freedom of worship. And he meant a broad thing there. He didn't mean just the right to go in your house of worship and do your thing and then leave it there. But one gets the sense, and several have noted this in print, including me, that this administration has sort of used that as a trial balloon, that to the Muslim world, for example, which is very, you know, very averse in many, many Muslim-majority countries to the notion that Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, and reformer Muslims ought to be able to get out in public and talk about religion. But the idea of freedom of worship is a little less threatening, if you can see that. I mean, even the Saudi government, which is one of the worst in the world on restricting religious freedom, will permit you, if you can get a Bible or another holy book into your room in Saudi Arabia, they won't harass you as long as you stay in your room and you pray and so forth. So that's freedom of worship. But if you bring it out into the public, which is where this issue is so important, then we see that there are huge restrictions. So it's very troubling when the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, in exhorting others to what ought to be freedom of religion, use the phrase freedom of worship. It can be a very narrow and impoverished element of the broader notion of religious freedom. And in fact, that is the phrase that was used in a very important Obama administration document called the National Security Strategy of the United States. It's a 60, 70-page document in which religious freedom isn't even mentioned, but there's this sort of parenthetical throwaway line, freedom of worship, which it alleges to be important and never explains why. So I think words are important. They need to be articulated properly, and then they need to be followed by policy action.
Mm-hmm. So how, then, is an insistence, to be on the very, very positive side, how is an insistence on religious freedom so important for the attainment of U.S. foreign policy goals?
Well, I think that's a great question. There are two dimensions of the answer. One is just the moral side here. You know, Americans have historically, over the course of our history, tried to stand with the persecuted of the world, not just persecuted on the basis of religion. Other types of persecution, physical, violent persecution, have gotten our, you know, our attention, and we've always wanted to stand with the persecuted, whether it's for you know, gender or economic reasons or political reasons. But religious persecution has always had a special place in American history. The country was founded by people fleeing religious persecution. Religious freedom is thought of as the first freedom, and in fact, it is the very first freedom articulated in the Bill of Rights. There's a reason for that. It has a special place in our history. So there's a moral imperative here. When, you know, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life has just, in the last 2 years, put out two reports, the second one just this month, a few days ago, in which it points out that something like 70% of the world's population live in countries, now think of that, 70% of the world's population lives in countries where their religious freedom is either highly or very highly restricted. And furthermore, it found in this recent report that in 126 countries in the world, there are only about 200, Christians are being harassed and persecuted. Some of this is violent persecution. But these are moral outrages, and it's right for us as a country to stand against it. But, and this leads me to the second answer to your question about why is it in our interest, why is it important for our foreign policy goals? We can't stop all the horrors in the world, whether they're religious or otherwise. I mean, they take place daily. People are being treated terribly for all kinds of reasons, including religious reasons. We simply don't have the power and the influence and the resources to accomplish the goal of ridding the world of this scourge. But what we can do, it seems to me, is understand the extent to which this problem affects our vital national interests. So here we're moving from a moral argument to a practical argument, an argument about American national security. And I think there are two things here. One, these countries of the world with whom we try to carry on economic and commercial relationships, and Lord knows that is a very important issue today in this globalized world where we're having a tremendous economic crisis. Those countries that are struggling to be democratic and to adopt some kind of stable democratic economic and social political norms can't do it if they don't have religious freedom. And here I'm talking about countries like Indonesia, way out in the Far East, or Pakistan, or those two countries where we have spent so much blood and treasure, Iraq and Afghanistan, or Egypt, which is an example of what some people have called the Arab Spring, although we're beginning to wonder about that Arab Spring.
Yes, indeed.
The point is, if they can't get this religion issue right, they'll never succeed as democracies. They'll never be stable. They'll always be in a tumult. So if it's an American interest for democracy to spread, which I think it is, I mean, I think that's unarguable, and nobody would argue that it's not in our interest. Of course, there are questions about what we do. I mean, do we use military force to impose democracy? What do? Religious freedom is a peaceful, diplomatic way of advancing democracy because they can't succeed if they don't have it. And finally, perhaps the most important answer to your question about our interests and our foreign policy goals is Islamist terrorism. It's not just bin Laden and his ilk, which continues to flourish despite his death. It is all of those who, if they had the means to do so, would kill us. They would kill our children, they would attack our country, and destroy it if they had the means to do so. And there are, unfortunately, weapons of mass destruction which could wreak havoc, as we all know. Religious freedom is a counter. It's a peaceful, diplomatic way to undermine the ideas which sustain this malevolent interpretation of Islam. If there has ever been an argument that religious freedom is in our national interest, it seems to me to be this one. And we ought to be much more vigorous and allocate more resources and time to this issue than we have.
And to that end, the new U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom was sworn in, I believe, just a few months ago. Does her background include both religious freedom and foreign policy experience? And what have you seen to date, and what are your future expectations?
Well, the answer to your first question is no, it doesn't. Dr. Susan Johnson Cook, who is the new ambassador, has a fascinating background. She's a very capable, highly educated American Baptist pastor who has been in New York until she took this job. But her background, other than her, you know, perhaps her Baptist instincts, included nothing on this issue. But look, she is there. I support her. I want her to succeed. I did advocate that they find somebody with a different kind of experience. But now that she's there, all of us in this community are vigorous supporters of her. And indeed, we have seen some interesting things come out. I have recently, just in the last 2 days, seen something come out of the State Department entitled, and I'm looking at it now, Religious Freedom and National Security. This was written by Ambassador Johnson Cook's office. And it makes the case that I just made to you. Now, it's called a fact sheet. What does it mean? So far, it's nothing but words. They're great words. But we've got to see policy. We've got to see some American resources applied to this. Words in this tough world mean very little unless they are actually pursued by American diplomats, American programs, and unless Congress gets involved. I would simply add briefly, Don, there is an amendment out there to the International Religious Freedom Act by Congressman Frank Wolf, H.R. 1856, for those who follow such things. It is wending its way through the Congress, which is now in recess. I fear for its fate in the Republican House of Representatives, of all places, which ought to be the greatest advocate for this cause that the country has. But there's a great deal of indifference to this. The Wolf amendments are vital to fixing the problems that are at the State Department and giving Ambassador Johnson Cook what she needs to succeed. So I urge your listeners, if they're interested in this issue, call your member of Congress, call your senator, tell them to support the Wolf Amendment to the International Religious Freedom Act.
Well, that actually answers in advance what was going to be my last question about what our listeners can actually do beyond thinking about this and especially praying about this issue. But I would like to thank you so very much, Tom Farr, for being on our program today.
You're quite welcome, Don. It's been a pleasure.
And for everyone, I strongly recommend an extremely important and good book that he's written, and the title is World of Faith and Freedom: Why International Religious Liberty is Vital to American National Security. And I most highly recommend it. And for everyone, if you have questions or comments to make about this or other of our centered shows, please contact me directly. My email address is dgb@centeredonline.org. A final word on this fascinating and critical topic. What if our Lord Jesus Christ's command to love our neighbors as ourselves were really translated into an insistence on authentic freedom of religion, including belief, speech, and practice, in places such as Saudi Arabia, or Afghanistan, or Cuba, or North Korea? Would that interfere with our obedience to the Great Commission, Jesus' command to go and make disciples of all nations? No, I don't think so. Not at all. I believe with all my heart that the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ is much more than competitive. His life, death, resurrection, and coming return may indeed be a stumbling block to some and foolishness to others, but it is nonetheless the word of life and the hope of the world. What I don't mean, of course, is a world conquered for Christ by political, military, economic, or any other human means. This would be contrary to the gospel of the kingdom, just as contrary as the political uprisings in ancient Israel envisioned by many of Jesus' early followers. Jesus consistently rejected such tactics. Rather, if there were a level playing field, so to speak, in which adherents of all religions were free to speak their minds today, the floodgates would be open to the incomparable grace of God poured out through our Lord Jesus Christ. We need to advocate full freedom of religion with all our might for all people so that the gospel may shine brightly among all the competing claims of the world's religions.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for your kind and thoughtful attention.
Yeah, and check out our website.
Remember, it's www.centeredonline.org.